Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us tonight on the Vigilance Press podcast. I have three guests with me tonight, so hopefully I'll be on my toes as your referee. But tonight we have once again the inimitable Dr. Comics, Jason Tondreau. How are you doing tonight, Jason?
I'm very well. And by the way, I have discovered that there is another Dr. Comics.
Oh, is there?
Yes, there is. And he's actually in the same field as me. He's also a comic scholar, but he lives in Australia.
So I was going to say Earth 2.
So I decided that I'm like the Marvel Comics Captain Marvel version of Dr. Comics. And he's the DC Comics Captain Marvel version of Dr. Comics.
I will have to get you both on the show.
he's a senior scholar. He's a very distinguished comic scholar. He's actually he's on the editorial board for a journal that that I occasionally submit articles to called the International Journal of Comic Art. I've never met him. I don't know him, but we know the same people. So if you're listening, Dr. Comics, I didn't mean it. I was given the name fair to square by somebody else, and that's why I use it. So you're the Fawcett Captain Marvel, and I'm Marvel Captain Marvel. True Dr. Comics.
Right, and anyone who knows their comics history will know that there's no shenanigans going on when says that.
No shenanigans. No.
Those two are so gonna fight.
Which leads me to the introduce one of our other favorite guests. Always glad to have you on, Christopher McLaughlin. How you doing tonight?
I'm great, sir. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. So, how are the dogs?
Jackson is bouncing back from his surgery nicely, and Maggie is her wonderful drooly self. And our other guest tonight has just recently paid her the best compliment ever. They met, and she said, "Your entire head is a wrinkle." So,
you would have said it too.
If I had been bright enough to think of it, I would have. So, she's still her adorable drooly self.
Fantastic, fantastic. So you've brought another voice with you, Lynn. Mm-hmm. Lynn Hill, right?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know if I was supposed to use all three names or not.
You don't have to. I know who
so
I am.
It sounds so much more ostentatious when I say Lynn Firestone Hill.
Yeah, I don't.
Heir to the Firestone Hill fortune.
Yeah,
oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
The Boston Firestone Hill.
There you go. Lynn, pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And it's lovely to have you on. And just so that folks don't think we're bringing on random strangers tonight.
let's explain how I got here.
Yeah. Well, you're randomly strange. You're not a random stranger.
You say the sweetest things.
I don't know what I'm saying anymore, but I'll take your word for it. So, Lynn and Christopher have known each other for how long here?
Oh, wow.
25 years.
25?
25 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think we're supposed to get a
cake
or something at this point, aren't we?
We probably should.
Lynn, were you in Chris's like tabletop Star Trek game and stuff?
Yeah.
She was my first captain.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Well, there you go.
Captain my captain.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was a good time. It was time ago, but it was a good time.
We have heard many stories about this fabled Next Generation campaign.
I'm not sure if that's good or not, but as long as he didn't bash the captain the whole time, then we're all right.
No.
Well, not you. It's the the follow joke. Because they're probably all going to be listening to this. It's a joke.
Yeah. Okay.
So, just give people a little heads up on what we'll be talking about tonight. We're going to start off with a few blatant, shameless plugs. everybody around the table should have at least one, but I think we've got like three for Jason. But when we get done with that, if you guys want to fast forward past the shameless plugs, you're welcome to do so. But I don't know when we'll stop.
No, they're not. But, no, they're not. Buy our crap. Buy our crap.
But after that, we will be talking about tonight the campaign creation topic and revisiting that with some more points of view, focusing a little bit more on getting players together for the first time, characters together. So you have that to look forward to. And with that said, let's go ahead and talk about a little bit about some of the great stuff that we do have coming up. And speaking of buy our crap. I'm actually really looking forward to talking about a couple of these things, but some people, I want to start off with Arthur Lives.
It's really good crap.
Yes, it is it's fantastic crap.
And we've worked really hard on this crap. So.
Yeah, it's you know, it's like a typo in Pokemon. It's magic crap. But
it's crap with an E and an accent mark on it. It's French.
It's crap.
For quality.
Yeah, it's crap.
For quality. For quality. That means something good in French. I'm reasonably sure.
There's two
and even
P's
if it doesn't, it'll sound good, right?
Moving right along.
Yeah, moving right along. So I want to let people know, people have been asking me, why haven't we done the Kickstarter? We were talking last year about doing a Kickstarter for Arthur Lives for Jason Tondreau. And one of the things that we've been looking at how Kickstarters work, and I've been trying to figure out the best way to really kind of play that out. And we do still intend to do a Kickstarter. We've decided to kind of wait until the lion's share of the manuscript is done for a couple of reasons. One, so that we can have as little time between doing the Kickstarter and the actual publication date as possible. But the other reason is we want to invite people who hit a certain reward level and higher. And I haven't determined what those will be yet, but invite them to help us playtest the rules, you know, immediately on, you know, even if the Kickstarter doesn't really make it, you know, we won't be waiting for that. It's like, as soon as you get your reward level, we're going to try and send you out some playtest documents so that we can get some feedback while we're doing the Kickstarter. So that we're probably looking at fall, I believe. So like about August for that.
Yeah, my summer writing project is Arthur Lives second edition.
Right, right.
Using the fate rule set.
Yeah, but between the time that he ends his current semester in school and the time that you know we do the podcast, I'm actually going to be locking him in a small room.
First I've heard about this, by the way.
We're going to be locking him up with a typewriter and a couple of gallons of whiteout to get this project on the road. No, I'm just kidding.
I will trade you my iPad and a vat of Diet Pepsi.
There we go.
You'll be much more likely to get the product done.
Right. I'll make sure to order that. So can I get Diet Pepsi on Amazon? so that's what's going on with that. And then coming up, actually, the thing that's currently in layout with Ruben right now is the Field Guide to Superheroes Volume 4 for Icons, which will be, ironically, the last chapter of the Field Guide series, but the first one to get print on demand.
Yeah. It's really great to finally see the fourth product coming out. I remember first time I did a podcast with Chris, and you asked him, like, so, you know, Chris, what have you got coming out? And he was like, I've got stuff coming out that I wrote a year and a half ago, and I don't even remember anymore. You know, and I don't remember what it was. It was, I think, some adventure that you'd written for M&M or something. Or no, I think it was the part of the Emerald City sourcebook.
And that still hasn't come out.
And and now this is kind of how I feel, and I'm like, wow, I sort of feel like Chris McLaughlin, and it's a good feeling, by the way.
God bless you, sir. God bless you.
It's true. We're finally getting the fourth volume of the Field Guide out, which means that we can the readers, and you know, God bless the loyal readers, have been waiting for the fourth volume. Because it's really all one big piece. I mean, if you look at the volumes, the archetypes go in alphabetical order. It's not like they're random. So it's kind of like getting, you know, the ultimate guide to the Marvel Universe, but having to stop after issue 7. But, you know, you know that you're missing everything from end to Z. So it's really great to finally have all 40 of the archetypes out, and all the interconnections between the characters are all there. So now you finally have, for example, all the members of the All-Americans or all the members of Project Atlas or the various other supergroups that are in the book, and all of their backgrounds are kind of all there. Yeah.
Did you ever hear the story about the Mayfair DC? What happened to them with their character books? They were doing loose leaf collections of all the DC characters.
Yeah.
And the license ran out before they got the fourth one out. The fourth one, which had some guy named Batman in it.
Oh right. Yeah.
But really, you know who was waiting on his stats, right?
Yeah. Well, you can
care.
Yeah, you can see the marketing technique here, right? We'll put, you know, flagship characters in every packet so that you have to buy every packet. Because if they organized alphabetically, then somebody would say, well, you know, who cares about W through Z? But
call me biased. I certainly – I don't have a problem with companies who do their DC character books alphabetically.
Yeah. No, I'm all for that too. I mean, I'm saying you can see the marketing wisdom of the way that that Mayfair did it.
Speaking of which, I've actually heard that some folks are actually getting their DC Adventures Volume 2, Heroes and Villains Volume 2 in the mail.
Sweet.
So it looks like it's actually out there in the wild now, and I'm still waiting for mine. John! Anyway. You put a rush on that. I'm actually really happy to see the Field Guide Volume 4 coming out. I think the art came together right around Christmas time. So we've had the art there for a while, but there's been delays in basically putting together other projects and prioritizing getting the print on demand working. And now that we have all of the, you know, all of the errors and everything understood and we've plotted that course, it makes it so much easier to start working on other projects. And from now on, we're looking at any project that's over a certain size, we're going to be looking to shoot for print on demand as opposed to just doing straight PDFs. So,
well, we went through a change of ownership and everything between volumes 3 and 4. I mean, the whole company changed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And one of the first things I sat down with Chuck when we were hashing out the deal to change ownership was that he wanted to make sure that, you know, the stuff that he'd started was going to get followed through on. And that's there's still a lot of stuff that I've inherited from that you know, manuscripts and so on, and some new editions of old previously published stuff that I plan to revisit. But it's just, you know, kind of one, something old, something new, kind of, I need to keep alternating and kind of show people where we're going. I didn't want to spend a lot of time kind of rehashing stuff that that we didn't have a chance. But I love the Field Guide series, and I'm really looking forward to getting that one out. And Ruben's done a great job on breathing some new life into the layout with some really cool character sheets. So I'm really looking forward to that. After that, we've got I believe what will happen, if I remember correctly, is we're going to do that, and then we're going to try and do a Devilish Duo. I believe it's one of Steve Perrin's Devilish Duos, because those are small. That won't be print on demand, but it'll be straight PDF. But when we come back from to the larger format, I think the next one's going to be Black Chapter from Jack Norris, where I've got most of the artwork done on that one. And then after that, we've got the Forgotten Five from Jason Tondreau, also known as Dr. Comics. So the Forgotten Five is looking great, by the way. I love the artwork.
I don't know if you guys are out there, if you know Jesse Justice or if you've seen his art before, but I had never heard of Jesse before James started to show me art. And I was like, wow, this guy knows. You know, I don't know what Jesse's style normally is, because these characters are all sort of inspired by, like, 1963 Marble Age supervillains. This is the idea, you know, like, let's make a group of supervillains who were the king of the world in the 1960s. They were like the biggest villains in the world. They were the Now suddenly I'm blanking on it. They were
the Hateful Eight.
No, no. Who were the villains that the Avengers fought in the
Masters of Evil?
Masters of Evil. Thank you. Save my bacon there.
Yeah. Anytime, good sir. Anytime.
Yeah. And bacon is worth saving. So,
amen.
Bacon.
An amen for bacon. but they were like, yeah, they were like the Masters of Evil. You know, I wanted to make this sort of really important, like I sort of described them as the Beatles of the supervillain era. But this means that in the modern day, in 2012, they're completely out of date. They're like as little read as old Marvel comics are read today. No, why would you read those when you could read the Ultimates, you know? anyway, but I say that knowing that our audience, and specifically Chris, is as much of an old Silver Age fan as I am. So
God bless you, sir. Thank you.
Yeah. So Jesse has done all of this really great, like sort of Kirby homage, Silver Age style artwork for us. And it's just awesome. It's just great. And I have no idea. James, you could tell me better. I mean, if his style is normally like this, I think you picked him because you knew that he could do it.
Well, Jesse and I met about 2 years ago online, and then I got a chance to hang out with him last year in person at the Baltimore Comic Con. And one of the things that really impressed me about him, I mean, I've always, you know, first of all, that he had already started designing logos for me before I even bought Vigilance. So like the Devilish Duos logo is one of his creations, and you know, he just has such a great professional polish on everything he does.
Yeah.
And he was very good going back and forth with me on stuff that you know, little tweaks and changes.
Yeah.
And he was really easy to work with. One of the things that struck me when I first got to see him work in person was that he's just as comfortable with classic media, ink and paper, as he is with the digital stuff. And not a lot of artists can do that. And he's also really good at kind of mixing his style up and doing different kinds of things. So when it came down to doing a Kirby project like this, or Kirby-inspired project like this, I kind of thought... originally I was looking at, you know, what was the likelihood of me being able to do some of the artwork myself and save myself some money. And then I realized my time was more precious than my money at that point. But and also I think people would like to see more variety, and they wanted to, you know, and I really wanted something to create a unique look for this particular project, because it was such a unique sounding project that I knew I really wanted somebody else other than me. And I kind of looked around, and I decided on Jesse because, you know, it was just one of those moments where I kind of was flipping through all the artwork of people I know, and I just looked at his stuff and I said, you know, his colors are so bold and bright, it makes me think of the old four color stuff.
Yeah.
And then I pitched the idea to him and said, you know, to see if he'd want to do it. And he threw me back some sketches, and it just clicked and everything was perfect. And I said, well, you know, go look up Kirby, and Jesse can correct me if I'm wrong, but I, you know, when hopefully we get him on the show, but I think his response was, well, I can't really remember what Kirby's stuff looks like, so I'll go do some research. Or something like that. And I'm like, really?
We should not have podcast that.
No. I mean, that's how good he is. I mean, he basically just kind of, you know, turned around and looked some stuff up and came back and came back with that picture of Tom Thumb, which I've shared on the Atomic Think Tank, and I've shared on Facebook. And, you know, that fantastic... you know, super tech chair that he's got, which looks like it was cloned right out of a Kirby illustration.
Yeah, it looks like something from Reed. It's great.
And I'm just like, yeah, that'll do.
you have to praise him now that you've essentially said, and then he said to me, what are these comic books that you speak of?
Yeah.
No, actually he's done some inking. He's done inking on comics. I don't remember. It's ghost inking. He doesn't actually have his name on credits, but
Somehow it sounds cooler when you put the word ghost in it.
Yeah, I know. He's been a ghost inker at least once. So you know, I don't know if we're allowed to say for whom or not, but
you've just given us the one position in comics that is less glorious than being an inker. Because not only are you the guy that everyone accuses of tracing, but you don't even get credit for it.
Pretty much.
To be fair, Jesse's inking is phenomenal.
Yeah, he's fantastic.
As an example of just to the audience out there, the kind of challenges that I had to make Jesse do for this thing, and you'll be, I think the readers will be happy when they see this because it's not just got five villains in it. It's got like all their minions and it's got tons of plots and stuff in it. And we're talking about how much more can we sort of squeeze in there to make sure that it's long enough and satisfies everybody. But one of the villains in the book, his name is Cadillac Jack. And Cadillac Jack answers the great question, what if Stan Lee had invented the Transformers in 1963?
Pretty much.
And when you think about it, you kind of have to ask yourself, you know, why didn't he invent the Transformers? Because it's totally a Stan Lee kind of idea, you know? So we've got this guy who gets caught in an alien invasion. He saves this alien from death, and the alien repays him by transferring his mind into a 1963 Cadillac Eldorado.
Watch Maggie.
What's that?
Nothing. Sorry. We have dog drama here. Please.
Ignore me. Ignore the man behind the curtain. Anyway, so you've got this guy who, you know, so you've got a Cadillac Eldorado that transforms like a transformer into a giant robot. So you have to draw a transformer, but he has to look like he came out of 1963 Marvel Comics. This is not an easy challenge.
No, it's not.
I had no idea what this guy looked like, and I've really learned from doing the field guide because in previous projects that I've done, other gaming projects that I've done, sometimes the artists have said, you know, kind of like, well, you know, they've drawn the guys, but I haven't really felt like the artist always had a very good connection to the characters because the artist didn't really feel like they had any input into the characters. And so on the five, I kind of said, I sort of intentionally didn't describe what a lot of these characters looked like. I talked about where their inspiration came from so you could kind of get a feel of, you know, where the character was coming from. And when I talk about how, you know, Cadillac Jack's based on this particular model of car, well, we can all look up that car on the internet. But what does he look like when he transforms into a giant robot? Fuck if I know, you know? So I let Jesse do it so that he, you know, so we can get all that great visual talent and skill. Because I'm a word guy. You know, I don't build robot models. I don't design giant robots. That's why God gave us artists. And so it's really been fun to sort of see what an artist comes in and does with this concept and how much fun they make of it and how they kind of make it their own. And the result is something that I never could have come up with on my own, which is great.
I want to see that sketch because all I can picture now is like a giant robotic Jack Norris.
Jack Norris. Only, you know, it's like he's like the only...
Motion to dismiss, Your Honor, because I'm a freaking robot.
The funny thing is that in our first, I was actually worried when I made it the name because in the October Men, there's also a villain named Jack.
Yes, jumping right? Spring Heel Jack,
and until I realized that what we actually need to do is embrace this concept so that all of our modules have a Jack in them, so that then we can do an adventure called Jacks Are Wild. In which the Jack from each of the different super teams all get up together to pull a caper. But
stay on after the show. I've got an idea. No, actually, if we get enough feedback, actually asking for something like that, you know, when we have some Jacks out there, that would be or you know pretty cool. But it always kind of you know it's like Jacks Are Wild. Would be great if at least one of them had like a card theme, but you know, being the video game nut I am, my first thought for a name would be Jack Attack, but I'm thinking of You Don't Know Jack for people who played
right,
that one.
Right. Well, that's like chapter headings. In fact, it should be at Crime Spree, right? And every crime has its own like Jack pun in the title. So they rob the card factory. They rob the playing card factory. They rob something else, and they have the You Don't Know Jack crime and. Anyway.
There you go.
Yeah. But another day.
I think it's one of those things that writes itself.
It does write itself, yeah.
I think we're doing it while the audience listens, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
So speaking of writing, currently in utero, we don't actually have the finished manuscript yet, but I've gotten a look at the progress so far, and I'm giddy with excitement. Lynn and Christopher are working on a project for us. I'm actually not sure what our deadline for this one is going to be just now, but my original hope was kind of shooting for Gen Con this year, but I'm thinking it might be easier to post, you know, to release it when it's done kind of thing, as opposed to trying to rush it, considering that I had to bump everything back. So it might not get out by Gen Con this year, but we shall see. But we are working on an adventure, finally, with Christopher, and the deal with Christopher was, well, he basically said, well, if you want to work with me, you got to work with my superior officer over here, Lynn.
Boy,
so. I believe the actual term was superior talent, actually.
Okay. So the real voice behind Christopher all these years is
so it is like forward. The guy behind the curtain.
Yeah, there you go. Well, Lynn, actually,
boy,
Lynn,
you
Lynn,
guys,
you guys are working on a an adventure for us, and it's one thing that I've always liked as far as modules go. When I look at adventures, I kind of always I'm always looking for multiple usage of something. You know, I want a project that I can get, you know, that's going to have like bad guys that I can use over and over again, or it's like an adventure that I can run over and over again that's like really good to introduce people to stuff. So it's basically going to be a tournament style game for Mutants and Masterminds, or adventure for Mutants and Masterminds, and that's kind of something that I haven't, at least for Mutants and Masterminds, I haven't seen much of. Most of the Mutants and Masterminds adventures I've seen have been these big epic things like Time of Crisis or Time of Vengeance or
yeah, and we're not doing crap like that. We're doing good stuff.
What I always look for in modules, you guys can tell me if I'm going to find it, is plunderable villains and stat blocks.
Oh, yeah.
In other words,
oh, heck yeah.
I stole all those Nazi villains from Time of Crisis. Is that what it was? That the one where the Nazis ran?
Yeah.
I stole all those villains, and I used them in another campaign, like, multiple times. I never got to actually run the adventure because I didn't have a tabletop M&M group. I had an online group. What can you tell us about the module that you're working on? Can you tell us anything about it?
Well, it got started when Lynn and I were just talking about general gaming ideas, and you see, this is my 15th year in the industry, and as anybody will tell you, you know, your 15th year is when your skills have completely eroded. You know, you're kind of like Brett Favre. You're just looking for a bunch of talented youngsters to kind of leech onto, kind of eke out one or two more championships before you completely fall apart. And so there.
How many have you gone through 15 years?
Yeah. I'm sorry.
How many retirements have you gone through?
I'm thinking about every time I go to RPGNet, I retire. much to the delight of many people there, I'm sure.
Every time you read Hero Noir, right? You
that book that guy borrowed my name to write? Yes. Totally. Yes. I'll never live that down.
I continue to love that book.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. I'll pass that along to the actual author. But anyway, so Lynn pitched me this. She didn't realize she was pitching me. That's how awesome she is. But she was telling me some awesome story ideas that she had, and I immediately said, "Wow, how can I find a way to get my name on this?" So I pitched the idea of co-writing it, meaning that, you know, that hopefully, you know, I could get my name on the credits somewhere, and I could see it playing out kind of like A Star Is Born, you know, when she's like taking the industry by storm. You know, I'm the one who can like drunkenly wander in and interrupt her award acceptance speech, you know, kind of like Kris Kristofferson, you know, totally hammered and tanked.
I'm really looking forward to that.
I'm giving you plenty of advance warning. Advance warning.
Well, I appreciate that part.
And then it's like, you know, even after I completely and utterly crater my career in life, you know, people will be saying, yeah, well, at least he brought Lynn Firestone Hill to the industry, and we'll remember him fondly for that, despite the, you know, his sordid end. you know, whatever, you know, embarrassing demise that I, you know, falling off the top of the Indiana Convention Center or something like that. You know, whatever, you know, however I go out, you know.
So did this start off when Chris was describing, he described it as a story. Did this originally start off as a fiction plot?
Most things do with me. Of course, this I had so many options going on in my head at the same time. When I was trying to get this down on paper, it almost turned itself into an adventure idea before it ever really got its feet under it as a story idea. So what James was saying about the variability and being able to use it for a bunch of different purposes, that is really the strongest thing about it, I think. We'll see how it comes out, but it's got, with the same set of characters and the same villains, you can run it at least four different ways that I've come up with. So once it gets out and everybody gets their hands on it, I'm sure there'll be 444 ways. So it should be fun.
Now when James says that it's a tournament adventure, what does that mean to you guys? What does that mean, a tournament adventure to you?
What we want it to mean is that there are certain sections of the game that are going to show up no matter which version of the characters you choose to run, that like the same basic set of events. And you can have, what would I call it, set goals for each of these separate chunks. Mm-hmm. And even if the characters in the background, the NPCs in the background, have been completely rearranged, you can still have, okay, we're going to have this kind of fight, and we're going to have this kind of fight, and we're going to have this kind of encounter, so that you can still compare apples to apples if you run it for two different groups. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, it's one of the things I always liked about tournament adventures was, like, if you remember the old tournament adventures for D&D, was that because they'd get run so often, and they were something you could pretty much do in one session. They usually had, a lot of the D&D ones had a high mortality rate for the players, but that to the side, you know, and they usually had some sort of really cool gimmick to it. And this one has a really cool, like, setting element to it that I really like. But they always had something that was really memorable about the setting or the story. And they were something that because so many people got exposed to them, there was a lot of, you know, people talking about it and comparing notes, like, oh, I took my, character through the Temple of Horrors or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I wanted from this adventure, was that kind of feeling of like, this could be something that everybody could, you know, play at least once. And one of the things that I recommended that they're gonna work in there is actually because a lot of the tournament adventures came with playable player characters. This will also have some, you know, player characters as part of the kit, you know. So that's something to look forward to, and we can talk more about those later on. But
you know, it suggests that we could get some sort of link with retailers. I mean, if you could do like an M&M event, you know, like on a weekend, like, here, we'll give you the module, and you get some players together, and if we get, like, you know, kind of like Worldwide Game Day, except obviously smaller.
Right.
You know,
Vigilance Game Day.
Yeah. We'll send out this adventure, and then you can get five or six people to play it. You've got characters already made, and then everybody's kind of playing at the same time. And, you know, we can, like, Twitter and Facebook about it while we play it.
and retailers, I'll show up if you ask me. It's free.
There you go.
I'll be there.
That would be fantastic. Jason, thank you for never thinking small.
Oh, you're welcome.
I know. You guys need to crank this back just a teeny tiny bit here. I am a complete and total novice, right?
No. I mean, even with
people like, you know, Chris and James standing over me and kicking me into the goal, you know, so that I pretty much can't screw it up hideously badly, I'm still a little new at this. So, you know,
trust me, folks, when I say I've actually read the manuscript, no, she's actually not. She may think she's a novice, but this is some very polished stuff. I'm really, really pleased with what I've seen so far.
I got to see the notes. You know, I'm off in the margins writing, hey, good spot for a fog hat reference. She writes stuff like, the players haven't suffered enough. and it's so weird because, you know, I look like a wanted poster. And I'm the guy trying to lighten things up. And Lynn is just adorable, but she's the one with, like, you know, this like evil, cruel writer streak in her. So,
oh,
you know,
I mean, love this module. Yeah, because I'm always telling my players, you know, that it's the degree of difficulty, the amount to which the heroes suffer, establishes their quality of being heroic.
I mean, exactly.
If everything is easy, well, then, you know, what do you have to brag about?
Exactly. We should put that in a sidebar. What to tell your players when they start crying?
Sold.
Well, Lynn, Chris will back me up on this. Before you start, you know, lowballing your contribution, you have to acknowledge that writing adventures is the unappreciated third rail of game writing, because we all need them. I mean, they're like the one thing that, mm-hmm. that game masters need more than anything is adventures. Mm-hmm. And they're the thing people least like to write because they're hard.
Yeah,
they are.
I mean,
hard.
They're only outstripped by film noir supers books as far as being underappreciated.
I swear, I didn't. It wasn't me this time. It wasn't me. I didn't mention it.
Okay. The opening was there. Somebody was going to take it. I might as well fall on my own sword.
GMs need adventure books. They need them really badly. But nobody writes them because they're hard to write, and there's this perception that they don't sell. That because only one person in every group buys them, mm-hmm. Their sales are low, and so they're not worth doing. And it's a terrible shame. But you know, so bully to you for taking the gutsy move and doing what is hard. Because I tell my writing students, you know, every day, if you're trying to figure out what to do on this assignment, ask yourself, what is the hardest thing I could possibly do? And the answer is, do that thing. And you'll be right more often than you're wrong.
And the other thing about writing adventures, I've found so far, at least, is that they are good for your, you know, keeping your ego in check, because everybody who uses this thing is going to cannibalize it to some degree or another. You know, I mean, all you're really doing is throwing out ingredients.
Yeah.
You know, and if somebody should happen to follow your recipe, well, that's peachy. But most people are not going to. They're going to pull bits here and there. They're going to make it fit their campaigns, or they're going to do whatever they have time to do with it, basically. Right. So you can't treat it like, you know, your little firstborn baby. It's not there for that.
Yeah,
it's stir fry. It's not baking.
Exactly. You don't have the flour. Doesn't have to be perfect. It's okay.
It's great to have an adventure out there. I mean, Chris, how many adventures are there for M&M that Green Ronin put out? How many adventures did Green Ronin put out?
Well, we put out the two standalones. Most of our source books have one tucked away in there somewhere. We do have several free ones up at the website, like the awesome chart. To the Freedom Brigade, or, you know, you could get something like, oh, I don't know, Deadly Day of the Dead Destructus for a minimal fee.
Right.
Just picking two at random.
But if we compare that to the number of, say, source books, I mean, it's vastly outnumbered by the various genre books that have come out for M&M, or, you know, things like archetype guides or stuff like that. I mean, you would think that the most frequent book we would put out would be modules, but in fact, they're one of the least frequent. Is that true?
Yes, and I kind of appreciate the reason why that is.
Yeah.
There was always this feeling at Ronin that we needed to have at least one adventure in print for every major thing that we did. So every edition gets it. And of course, you know, we're trying the new adventure path module, model that seems to be working out well. So, I mean, you know, they're out there. It's just, you know, I mean, it's evolving into a different format than I think anything we've seen before.
Yeah.
At least for Ronin.
So is this one that you guys are working on? Is this like
we should give it a name so people know what they're
yes,
listening.
It's sitting on my hard drive as Untitled Lynn Firestone Hill Project.
Lynn and I were chatting back and forth, and
wasn't Firestone the name of the secret project in the Bourne Identity?
No, Treadstone.
Treadstone, excuse me. Okay. I was going to call it Operation Firestone.
Sorry, I was a big fan of that first movie.
That's good.
But no, actually, Lynn and I were talking, and I think Beyond the Pale is our working title.
I like that.
Yeah, I like it too. I like it too.
The neat thing about it, and I think people will get a kick out of it, is that it has a really kind of remote, creepy vibe to the setting that I don't know if we want to spoil it all. We'll go ahead and tell them. It's basically a, if I were to kind of place it, if you guys have ever seen John Carpenter's The Thing, it's kind of like a superhero adventure version of that kind of setting. Not necessarily the plot. I don't think we get into the who goes there kind of plot, but the setting, the vibe of it, you know, the cold and the very remote location.
The cold, the dark, the isolation. These are, yeah, you know, that hothouse vibe with a bunch of people who are stuck and can't get out. That's what we're going for.
Yeah.
Lynn practically standing on the cover, pointing at you, screaming, "You're all gonna die."
That's hard to do with superheroes. I mean, it's hard to put them in a closed environment and say you can't get out when they're superheroes. They could have any power in the world.
Yeah, it's more a matter of, in the superhero's case, they may be choosing not to get out. But yeah. It depends on how you play it, too. I mean, there are ways to physically trap them there.
Oh, of course. I mean, the GM can always wave his hand and say, "Oh, your teleportation doesn't work." But
sure,
it's much more interesting if the heroes are kind of obliged to stay because there's innocent people that can't get out or whatever.
Exactly. Exactly.
Very cool.
So, yeah, we're really looking forward to that.
She's making that really evil finger pyramid now. You can't see it.
I can hear it. That,
all according
that,
to plans.
That trilling music, the violin shrieking there.
Yes, I think you're all beginning to understand my evil plan. Yeah, no, it should be fun. It should be fun. I don't know, maybe I'm a little bit twisted, but I really do think crap like that is fun. So
So if anybody's ever been complaining that, like, you know, adventures aren't hard enough, I think you guys will get a kick out of that one. You know, for your sacrificial lambs, again, you will have some provided player characters so that the players don't have to sacrifice their own heroes to the altar of Lynn Hill's, you know, evil plan. if they're feeling a little bashful or risky about that. But you know, it's one of the things I like about it is, you know, what a tournament should be, a tournament module should be, is something you can go to a convention, pull this out, slap it down on the table, and have everything you need to run.
Yeah.
That and the rule book, and you're ready to go. And that's basically what we're shooting for.
Exactly.
And, you know, you won't need to go, "Oh, hey, look these stats up over in you know, the Game Master's Guide," or anything. No, everything's going to be in that one book, and you'll be ready to rock.
Yeah, personally, when I run stuff, I tend to be rules light anyway. You know, if I've got a chart in three books, then I'm going to copy that chart out of the three books and put it in my notebook so I have what I need. And I'm not a page flipper when I'm trying to run stuff. So, it's yeah, that's definitely what I'm going for.
What games are you playing right now, Lynn?
Right now, that would be a whole lot of nothing, but I know it's terrible.
It is.
But I've played a lot of 3.5 D&D. I've played Champions, Call of Cthulhu. Oh, yeah. You know, all that good stuff.
I have passed on to her the writer's curse that once you start writing, you no longer have time to play.
Curse you, Chris McLaughlin.
See, and I hear y'all thought I was evil.
Yes, oh, and one thing.
She's that cool calculated cigarette holder evil. I'm more like the zombie. I'm just biting whoever gets close.
Nom. You're the evil nommer. One thing I did forget to mention when I was talking about, and this is something I just kind of had a flash here, so I apologize for backtracking all the way back to Arthur Lives, but one thing that I was really giddy with, and I mentioned it on Facebook, so if you're following on Facebook, you'll forgive me for repeating this, but if anybody has already seen the artwork that I was showing a few months back when we got it from Denise Jones, the cover art for the for Arthur Lives it's absolutely fantastic, and I'm so pleased to announce that she's agreed to do some more interior artwork for us for that project and is starting on that. So we're actually getting some more artwork moving that we can use then to both promote it and show you guys what's going on. And as per Jason's request, we basically had her take the characters that she created for the cover and basically give us illustrations of those characters so that he can write them up for the book. So that's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, Denise did this. We did this wonderful brainstorming where she was like, well, how do you want to do them? You know, these guys are like reincarnated characters in the Arthurian myth. But what kind of theme do you want for the cover? And we sort of threw around ideas like, well, maybe they're a sports team or maybe they're a street gang or maybe they're a whatever. And she said, what if they're a band? And I said, yes.
I love it.
Yes, what if they're a band? And so then she started thinking like, well, we'll make the Arthurs like a reincarnated John Lennon. And I'm like, oh, I want to marry you. I mean, that's... and so then it was okay.
I got dibs. I saw her first.
I have a wife. I've already I was exaggerating for effect. She said, well, what if Guinevere is like a reincarnated, what if she's like sort of like Stevie Nicks? And I'm like, yeah, I like this too. Of course, Stevie Nicks is not dead, but we're...
and we're not wishing that she is.
We're certainly not.
And then we started throwing on other bands, and it just, the cover just really came together. And so now we've got a Gawain and a Merlin and an Arthur and a Guinevere all on the cover. And she made these great character designs. And so now I'm like, okay, well, now I totally have to put these guys in the book and make them, because Arthur Lives is a setting in which example characters actually become informative and instructive. Because a lot of people can be very sort of uncertain about how far can you go with these characters. Well, I'm going to make a reincarnated Arthur, but does that mean I have to be, you know, the same way that Arthur's always presented? I mean, he's kind of boring just to many people. Or if I'm going to be Lancelot or I'm going to be Gawain, do I have to be this kind of knight, sort of stereotypical knight? And one of the things that I'm trying to get across with Arthur is that all those borders are erased. I mean, you can make your version of Lancelot whatever you want. He can be from any country in the world. He can be any faith in the world. He can be male or female or transgender. He could be anything. He could be a dock worker. He could be a billionaire. He could be Bill Gates. He could be anything, whatever you want. And so taking these examples from Denise, they're not NPC heroes in the book just for the sake of being NPC heroes that nobody will ever play. They're there to sort of show the player, hey, I actually have a lot of room. You know, I can take this idea, okay, I'm Merlin, but I can be whatever kind of Merlin I imagine. And it's actually really liberating in a way. So I wanted to, and I just love it when Denise got involved. And so I want to take those characters, make them part of the story. And it's just wonderful that she's going to be involved. I'm hoping that we're going to do some play testing of Fate pretty soon. And James can confirm this, but we're going to do podcasts for the Fate play testing. And I would really love, other people that are involved with the project to play test, including people who I very much admire, like Mr. Chris McLaughlin
God bless you, sir. God bless you, sir.
And Lynn,
check your PayPal account.
Yes. Lynn, if you have time and you would be up for a little playtesting of some, you know, kind of King Arthur or some Fate, or I don't know if you played either, if you played Fate at all, but I would love to.
God, yes.
That sounds so fun.
Good.
I would love to get in on that.
To quote Chris, God bless you, man.
Well, we'll reserve a seat for you then. I've actually spoken to Denise, and if she can work it into her schedule, she's going to try and join us for that too. So
my secret plot here is to get all of my potential collaborators involved, so that after the first book comes out, somebody says, "Hey, can I write an adventure for that?" And I can say, "Yes, yes, you can."
Fantastic. Okay, so let's since we've covered this back and forth, let's actually switch tacks now, since we were actually talking about starting campaigns and everything. The last time I had Christopher and Jason on, we were talking about mostly superhero conventions when talking about campaigns and setting up campaigns. And I think I don't know if we ever got around to it, but the topic that I kind of wanted to cover tonight was really, how do you get the characters together, like for their first time, you know, and what are some ways that you can really like mimic the comic books, and what comic book tropes don't work that well. Let's start with Christopher. what are your favorite ways of kickstarting the game, getting the players together?
Favorite ways, two immediately spring to mind. One of them is because it's a callback to one of my favorite Mystery Science Theater episodes of all time. There was an episode where they were doing an invention exchange, and Joel brings out this radio that only plays stuff from like classic TV sitcoms and shows.
Mm-hmm.
It has like the generic teen dance music that everybody from Ernie Douglas to Greg Brady has grooved to. And my all-time favorite, it had like the incredibly specific all plot point station.
Yes.
You know, you would tune it in, and it would be like, this just in, you know, Gotham City Bank is being robbed by a man in a green suit covered with black question marks. Door at 11. So I have actually shamelessly mentioned the all plot point station in both Silver Age and Golden Age I make no bones about it, about how really lame and cliched it is. But, you know, let's face it, if you're doing Golden Age and Silver Age, if you plunk down your hard-earned dollars, American or Canadian, to get that, then, you know, I think that you have a certain built-in level of affection for those kind of tropes. So I put them in there with good humor, gambling that I knew my audience. And so I would put that in there as the most blindingly obvious, and yet maybe with a bit of meta entertainment built in way of doing it.
Well, it's the superhero version of you all meet in a bar, right?
Yeah, I was just going to say that.
Yeah.
Of the D&D, you know, you all meet in a pub, and a guy staggers in with an arrow in his chest and a note.
Mm-hmm.
And he croaks, "Rosebud." Oh wait, no, sorry, I'm getting my genres mixed up. My bad.
Well, he could. I'd play that game.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Now, if you want to go the opposite direction, get like really innovative and cutting edge. Okay?
Yeah.
That guy that wrote Noir, whoever he is.
Yeah. You
know, that desperate, lonely shut-in.
That deadbeat.
I love his style, though. I love that guy's style.
Thank you. I'll pass that along. Okay. One of the things built into that was everybody had in the best traditions of genre, everybody had to have some really 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 horrible thing they had done or participated in their past that they were desperate to cover up. And there was I haven't read it so long. I hope this survived to the final draft. If it didn't, hey, here you go. Here's a little cut material from Noir. Then we'll sell it that way. Basically, once you got your characters designed, you had to pick at least one other person in the group who knew your secret.
Right, yeah.
And so I just loved the idea of starting a campaign where, like, the most horrible thing you've ever done is known by one other person. All of a sudden, you're in a room together.
Yeah.
Because I figure, you know, I mean, how many campaigns do you start off right at the beginning? You've got that behind your ex-girlfriend in line at the DMV level of awkward. Wow, that's certainly you there, isn't it?
And this has actually become kind of a thing in gaming lately. It's, you know, the sort of the campaign burning approach. And I think I forget the burning wheel is, I think, where this started.
Mm-hmm. It's Spirit of the Century, and they do it like all things magnificently and definitively.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, you get like six people in the room. It's okay. So each one of you, like, was on an adventure with two other people. So you sort of describe those adventures, and what you end up with is a group of people who all kind of already know each other by way of each other. They sort of play 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But your emphasis specifically makes it an awkward connection.
Well, I thought what better way to get some role playing going than like you were the one who saw the I had a bunch of friends who were venturing into online dating, and like at the time, and had a couple of them who had wound up thinking that, you know, they'd found the love of their lives, and it was somebody from like two cubicles over.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then they had to go to the, oh yeah, that was totally you on that date, wasn't it?
Oh,
yeah. So, you know, it was just sort of my homage to the awkwardness and personal wreckage of my friends' lives. Because we writers are vampires. We suck on other people's misery.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sad but true.
Yeah.
So what's your favorite approach, Lynn?
Well, I have not started as many campaigns as some of my friends have done. I have not been too proud to use the everybody meets in a tavern approach. for me, the best way to do it is just to pick the right group of players and pick people who are going to come into it with a very clear idea of who their characters are and a very clear idea of where they want to go. And when you have people like that, you can anything is going to work. When you've got good role players who have all got a character concept that they're excited about, it doesn't matter how you start them. And if you've got a group of players, conversely, who it's a bunch of sociopaths, then there's nothing you can do that's going to make these people interact with each other. So much of it depends on the players. Yeah, I really feel like whatever you do, there are ways that you can make it easier or harder, but it's so much. You have to sit down with the players individually, find out who they are and what they want to do and what kind of person they want to play and what kind of campaign they want to play. And then you take what you learned from all those different people and you smush it all together. It's an individual thing.
The smushing approach.
Yeah, the smushing. But the smushing is different for every group, you know, and every set of players.
Custom smushing.
Yeah, it's customized smushing.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, oh boy.
So actually, one of the things that you mentioned kind of resonated with me, the idea that, you know, getting a player a character that they're excited about, that makes things so much easier. But one of the things that kind of presupposes on the part of the GM, and this can be, you know, some people are really good at this, some people need a little help, but for me, this is one of those things that really makes a game easier for me, is when the players are excited about their characters and they have like a scene that they want to start off with, and they're kind of excited about, I would love to see, you know, my character swing in on a web line, or I want to see, you know, my character rescue somebody from like a burning building or something, and
you know what my standard response to that was? I was just gonna go, and I was totally gonna do that.
Yeah. That sounds like such a Jack line right there.
Well, I agree with Lynn. I think that you know, your point there is well made, and that's that some players players understand the challenge of bringing the group together.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're lucky, they work with you, and they, you know, they want to help. So the players say, you know, well, do I know any other heroes that could help in this situation? And you're like, well, yeah, actually, you do. And you know, and mm-hmm. they can because they can be partners in the process. They don't have to be obstacles. Sometimes we get characters and players that are obstacles because, as you were getting at there, they're loners. They're actually loner characters, and they don't want to hang out with other people because they're so busy being dark and broody.
Yeah.
And that can be a real challenge.
Thank you, Wolverine, for ruining so many players.
You know, and the funny thing is that Wolverine in the original, you know, the X-Men, when he first shows up, he does what people ask him to do.
He shows up
his mind and says, Wolverine, you've got to come help us. And he's like, okay, Chuck, but I'm not going to like it.
Yeah.
And the character says, I'm not going to like it, but the player is there like, oh, yeah, I'm in.
Yep.
And sometimes the player just has to tell the other players, okay, look, my character is going to complain about everything. He's going to say he doesn't want to help you. He's going to say he doesn't want to go on the adventure. Just ask him to go and he'll go. But he'll just bitch about it. And sometimes you just have to sort of, you know, make it up front. You kind of have to meta talk through it, and it'll work fine.
At least until the PCs all get used to each other.
Yeah. Yeah.
Until you kind of hold their hands through it until they get past that opening.
Yeah.
Those opening two or three fights where they're like, oh, God, it's that whiny guy.
You see, that's where you can use my dark secret approach. And every time they try to bug out on the team, you can have a person that knows their dark secret going like, I got two. Oh, you're wandering off. Well, let me remind you a little something of your past, your pal. Move. Like, right, shut up. I'm in.
Yeah, because you know, blackmail cements every friendship. That's right.
Yeah.
Well, really, for the first 42 years of my life, I had my pathetic begging and blackmail. There you go. Those were my two go-to ones.
I have often shamelessly stolen from, you know, my favorite comics when it comes to setting up the players, and you can, you know, you rotate out the individual names and the things, but the plots are the same. You either have the Fantastic Four number one. Launched, which is giant monster bursts out of the ground in the middle of the city. Every hero in town come to stop it, which is a classic and works perfectly well. Or you have the mysterious mentor calls all the heroes together and says nuclear weapons have been stolen by Mastermind and thugs. Go stop him, right? Which is the first issue of the X-Men. Or you have my favorite, which I actually have used once, and it went to pretty good effect, which is heroes, all the famous heroes of the greatest super team on Earth all quit at the same time and draft no-name third stringers to be their replacements. and that's which is Avengers 14?
That's scary, man. That's really scary.
When Iron Man and Thor and all those guys, Giant Man, all quit the team at the same time, and they leave Captain America in charge, and he has to get Scarlet Witch, Hawkeye, and Quicksilver to round out his team.
Because Arm Fall Off Boy was working for DC.
You're laughing at me, Chris, but you know this comic. I know you do.
I do, and I'm sitting here wondering if that other Dr. Comics could come up with Avengers 14 off the top of his head.
God bless you, sir. But I ran that one. The way I did that was the first episode of the campaign, I gave everybody a character. And they were actually the characters in the field guide. So one guy was playing the champ, who's my Muhammad Ali with superpowers riff. And one guy was playing Victoria, who's my Supergirl/Phoenix sort of homage, and so on. And I gave them all characters. And then I said, okay, now here is your secret mission card. And I gave them all a 3x5 card, on which I had written on the back of the card the thing that they had to do by the end of the session. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But what they didn't know is that on the back of the card, I wrote, you must quit the team for every single member of the team. Okay. So we played through this big, massive space adventure, which I was sort of riffing on the famous Death of Thanos storyline, where Adam Warlock and the Thing and Spider-Man and all of the Avengers all show up on Thanos' space arc, where they fight like every bizarre alien that Starlin could draw. And I was ripping on that adventure. And at the end of it, like somebody says, I just don't believe in this team anymore. I quit. He throws in his card. And suddenly everybody else in the room realizes that they all the cards say the same thing. And so then they all start sort of throwing the card. Well, you're such a jerk, and I can't believe I ever worked for you. I quit too. And we were all just hysterical by the end of it because everybody made this big deal out of their I quit scenes. So then
you know, I totally would have had to go, I'm quitting this team to go off of me with my avant-garde Japanese girlfriend.
Yes. You would do
Thank
that.
Thank you. Yes.
So then after everybody had quit, I said, okay, guys, now let's make characters. You guys are going to be the replacements that have all gotten to fill out this team that all of your other characters just quit. And it worked out really well. It was crazy fun. And it was all inspired by, that famous Avengers scene when all the Avengers quit and they leave Captain America to recruit these, all ex-villains and third stringers to be his team. So that's what I did.
That's actually a pretty cool story. That uses a technique that I've used before to kick off even not whole campaigns, but just the really, really cool adventures where I have the players take over the role of some NPCs for like the first act. Mm-hmm. And I often murder them all by the end of the first act to establish a credible threat, so that they feel like, uh-oh, now my real character's stepping in and I might actually die because this threat is really dangerous and threatening.
Yeah.
But that was a trick I used when I was running a horror campaign. And that was really successful for me, but I'd never actually thought to use it in that way. That's really cool.
You know, when Kurt Busiek was writing about, he was responding to fan criticism and comments about when he was writing the Avengers. This is in the Heroes Return era of Marvel, where the Avengers had all been published by Image Comics for a while, and they'd all been like really bent over. And Busiek got him back, and he was rewriting the Avengers from issue one. And the first three issues, the villain is Morgan Le Fay. And everybody gave Busiek a lot of hell for this. They're like, well, why didn't you use Loki? Or why didn't you use Kang? Or somebody that's like a first, why didn't you use Ultron? Why didn't you use, a big villain instead of Morgan Le Fay? Morgan Le Fay was Spider-Woman's archenemy, okay? And Busiek's answer, I thought, was very insightful. He says, because that's not the point. If I use a big villain, it becomes an Ultron story. It becomes a Kang story. It becomes, a Doom story or whatever. I didn't want it to be about the villain. I wanted it to be about the heroes coming together. And it's an Avengers story. And he picked a third string villain on purpose.
And you so know that's the third draft of that response.
After the screw you jerkwad, I'm writing Avengers.
Yep.
Yeah. Maybe so.
Yeah, that's something that I have noticed is that sometimes the most memorable scenes in comic or in like superhero games that I've run happen between the players and like really obscure or just not center stage villains.
Yeah.
Like one of the most, I was running a kind of Batman Beyond style game in the Freedom City setting where it was, the year 2525 or 2025. And the characters were in the middle of a chase scene where they were just chasing after some random hover skateboard riders that were, you know, causing problems. And I made it a big chase scene where the characters, you know, power level 10 superheroes just having trouble trying to catch up to these obnoxious punks. And they had a blast with it. You know, it was just one of these scenes that they remember and talk about. But it was one of these moments where I was like, that was just kind of there to you know, have a little jolt of fun before the opening credits. That wasn't necessarily supposed to be the highlight of the game. But, you know, it's strange what people will gravitate to and what will be considered fun. Because a lot of times when they're dealing with the heavy... Like Jason said, it becomes more about the villain than it is about the heroes. So, mm-hmm. they're more concerned with success or failure than they are with the fun of role playing. So
my point just there was just that, you know, if you're a GM, if you're a new GM and you're thinking about creating a new campaign and you're like, well, I don't know how to bring the characters together. You know, listen to Lynn. Just
try and kill them.
Smush them together. The pretext might even seem fairly thin to you, but you know what? No one's going to care. They want to play together, so give them an excuse, and they will. And then you can have the origin scene behind you, and you can start working on the actual storyline. You know, and just don't sweat it too much. Dive in. Don't let the first getting the players together scene intimidate you. You know, give your players the benefit of the doubt and tell them, you know, look, let's kind of all get together here and do this, and they'll help you. They'll do it.
Yeah, I mean, unless you've just got some real winners in your group, in which case nothing is going to be fun. So, you know.
You can always just start the game off with the Blues Brothers showing up and going, we're trying to get the band back together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Nothing wrong with the little Blues Brothers.
You know, and it's funny, you know, one of the things that I try to do occasionally is, you know, some of these, like, first adventure get-togethers, there are some that I think wed themselves to certain genres. And I always, one of the things after I'd launched four or five campaigns was to try to pull something that you normally associate with from another genre and use that as my opener. Like, if you're doing, like, a horror role-playing game, your standard opener is you get hired to find out what happened to the first expedition. You know, and then, as you go along, you start finding corpses and, you know, parts of corpses and what used to be human, something like that. And I basically used that opening to open up a Star Trek campaign once. You know, mm-hmm. where, you mm-hmm. know, that my players were all on different ships and they were on a search and rescue mission. And they found the ship that they were eventually all going to be on, just drifting in space with nobody on it and very few clues. And yeah. My sort of running backstory for the first big arc that I did was them bit by bit finding out what happened to the previous crew.
Yeah.
Oh, that's why there's a blood stain there. Okay, makes perfect sense.
Yeah, that was an old Traveler adventure did that, where the...
Oh, yeah, it's older than hell, but, you know...
It is. You remember it, where they find this old ancient relic ship that's got mysterious hyperdrive technology that nobody understands, and the players salvage it, and it becomes sort of designed to be their base.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I've always, you know, I never got the chance. I always wanted to do like a superhero adventure where, like, you know, they're sort of like, what happened to the heroes who used to protect this town? And everybody in town just shudders whenever you ask that question.
Oh, that's a great idea. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so, yeah, so throw that one out there.
Yep. There's a freebie for folks listening in.
Oh, crap. I could have charged for that. Good night, folks. Good night. Thank you very much. I'm out of here.
I'll be here all week. Be sure to tip your waitress. Now, one of the things that I really like about that first session, although one of the things it cuts both ways, is getting to see, you know, which of the players really digs their character and you know, where everything comes together, where, you know, if you like with Mutants and Masterminds, especially, you spend a lot of time, depending on who you are, building the character, you know, figuring out how the points work, figuring out, you know, how to come up with some cool gimmicky power that maybe isn't necessarily, as straightforward, you know, on paper as it was in your head, but trying to figure that sweet spot. And then you go through all this trouble of building the character and making the cuts where you need to in order to come in under your point budget, yada, yada. And then you hit the game and, you know, sometimes everything comes together, sometimes it doesn't. I tend to always offer my players a what I call an oops, but it's basically just after the first session, you know, I allow my players to go and rebuild their characters if they want to kind of reflect the character they played. Because sometimes you find yourself, you know, with one idea going in, and then you hit the rest of the players and everything changes because you're suddenly relating to other people and your perspective on the character changes. So it's always nice to give the players a chance to explore that and actually reflect that with, you know, it's like, well, I didn't realize that my character was going to be the leader. Maybe I should find some points and put it into leadership and drop this intimidation focus and whatever. And that's fine, you know, or, you know, other things. But the player that, you know, and then the flip side of that is always finding the player who just, you know, kind of comes away going, man, that sucked. Yeah. It's like nothing worked the way I wanted it to, or I kept rolling badly and my character didn't look as cool as I wanted to, and I just didn't feel the magic, and I don't know, I don't want to play that. You know, I'm always very generous about letting people bring in new characters, but, you know, how often do you guys try to just go, well, give it one more try or something, or are you more along the lines of, no, just go ahead and change it out? I mean, when something like that happens, when a player just comes away going, feeling unsatisfied by their character the first session, what do you guys do?
Well, if it's a crummy dice night, then they should probably give it another session. Just to make sure, because anybody, you could be playing the character that you love the best in the whole entire universe, and if the dice hate you, you're not going to have fun. You know? So if it's just something like that, it's probably worth waiting it out and trying it one more time. But if it's something deeper than that, if they're just not connecting with the character the way they hope to, then, you know, that's a different story.
Go ahead, Jason.
Oh no! I was going to say that it takes a special kind of person to have fun, even when you roll is ones. I don't do it very well, but I know some people that they don't care. You know, they just have fun no matter what they roll. Mostly because we all know that person who always rolls poorly in whatever game you're in, right? Who just always has bad dice, and they're so resigned to it that they're just honestly pleasantly surprised whenever they roll anything higher than a 7. You know? I have a policy similar to James. I have what I call a shakedown cruise policy, where the first couple of adventures, usually, I say, if you want to change something in your character sheet, what I do try and hold, though, is if you've used something, you can't change it. You can I tend to prize narrative consistency. So, you know, if we saw you use your chilling gaze power in the first session, well, then you can't swap out your chilling gaze power for something else.
Yeah, that seems reasonable.
But if you have a power that you feel like you never got to use, and that's usually what happens. The player comes to me and says, well, I spent all my points on this thing, but I don't feel like I'm using it. It seems like I wasted points. Mm-hmm. Well, then spend them somewhere else, right? And my tolerance for this increases as the complexity of the game increases. You know, M&M is kind of medium complexity. We all know games that are a lot harder and more complex than M&M, and I'm thinking of sort of notoriously complicated systems like Hero System or Rollmaster or something like Ars Magica, which I've run lately. My shakedown cruise period lasts longer the more complicated the system is, because often the players just don't know the system, and so they've had to make up their characters kind of by guesswork sometimes. Mm-hmm. And they feel like they've misspent points or they've cheated themselves out. But it's been a long time since a player just flat out said, I want to change characters because this guy's just not working for me. There's not much you can do at that point besides say, okay, you know, you want to change, then change. We'll work the new guy in. That's cool.
One thing I would say, not necessarily to outright contradict you, but
yeah.
One thing that I find that's nice about Mutants and Masterminds specifically, and other games that allow you to kind of power stunt off of your existing powers, is that even if you do use an effect in the first adventure, but you realize, well, I just spent a lot of points on this, but what I really wanted to do is this thing. And I'm like, well, you know, you could easily have power stunted what you did off of this other idea.
No, that's a good point.
There's, you know, as long as the core, you know, power abilities, you know, the core concept isn't too far off.
No, that's a good point. I hadn't thought of that. That's true.
But, I think that kind of consistency will help the other players too, because, you know, if they come back to the gaming table and, you know, two of the characters are suddenly completely different than what they remember, it kind of gives them it takes away from their ability to immerse themselves, because then they're not sure what's going on, and they lose a little of that narrative consistency. So what's your take on it, Christopher?
I'm hiding under the couch. Because I only had to deal with this once, and the good ideas you have just make me feel all the more ashamed of the way I handled it. Because we had just switched from one really long running Star Trek campaign to another. We did one session with the first session with the new campaign setup and the new characters and whatnot else. And I think I'm obligated to tell a story about him every night. So let me go ahead and say, hey, Skip. You want to say hi to Skip, Lynn?
Hi, Skip.
Okay, there we go. All right, here's your Skip Morton story for tonight. He came to me after the first session and said, you know, playing this new character just makes me realize how much I miss my old one. So in between adventures, we killed off his old character in an unspecified accident. We just spent the rest of the semester coming up with like outrageous lies about. They just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger about how his character died. It just became a running joke, and then we brought him back the second week as the brother of his old character. And looking back, I mean, God loves Skip. He was always more awesome than the games that I was putting him in. But, you know, looking back, I so wish I'd just done like a Bewitched and like, okay, Darren looks completely different. We're all just going to ignore that fact. Nobody's going to go, holy crap, what happened to Mrs. Kravitz? This isn't the old Mrs. Kravitz. And what's that freshly plot of freshly dug earth in your yard, Mr. Kravitz? You know, I really wish I hadn't called any attention at all to the switch, because really it was badly handled by me. And just like I said, it just became this out of control joke, you know, as to what happened to that one lone character. Oh, well, there you go. There's an example of what not to do. You do the Bewitched approach. Just ignore the change. Yeah.
I think it was Robot Chicken where Hulk was talking about the at that time impending reboot of the Hulk movie franchise, and he was like, first rule of reboot, don't talk about reboot.
I remember we were playing an old game, and you know, some role-playing games are very lethal, and Eminem is not one of them, but we all know game systems that are lethal, and we were playing a RuneQuest game of all things. Yeah, you remember RuneQuest, and you know, you could accidentally kill yourself if you rolled low enough. And somebody did an analysis in Murphy's Rules one time, I remember. You know, in any confrontation of 10,000 men fighting 10,000 men in a session of RuneQuest, five of them will chop their own heads off. So we were playing the session, and of course a guy made his character, and he died in the first session, and he plaintively went before the GM with his character sheet in hand at the end of the session, and none of us knew what had happened. And the second session, there he is, the twin brother of the first guy, exactly the same, all with his exact character. Just his twin brother that none of us knew about until we showed up, you know.
God, I feel so much better now.
Yeah, but you know what? At this point, it was like, so what? You know, we didn't care. This also goes back to what Lynn was talking about, you know, half an hour ago. It's about getting the players together. Just get them together and keep moving. You know, there's nothing to see here.
Well, one thing I've noticed is that different player groups handle this very differently, and you get certain people for whom, you know, the challenge between, you know, there's a certain level of antagonistic role of the GM versus the players in some group. And for these, I seem to see a much more rigid conformity to continuity. Like if somebody dies, okay, roll up a new character,
right?
You know, kind of thing. And, you know, that's fine if everyone on the group is on the same wavelength. You know, as with all gaming, you know, if you've got different players with different ideas, you know, if you want to keep the group together, you're going to have to adapt to that. But, you know, I think it's interesting to see. I personally see that in my experience, rather, Mutants and Masterminds tends to bring together the people who are a little more flexible, have that kind of cooperative storytelling going on between the GM and the players, as opposed to more confrontational type.
But you know, M&M players are better. Science proves it.
It's like all facts are made up on the spot, right?
I enjoy M&M. I'm not going to say anything bad against any other game systems because everybody's got their favorites. But
and I adore your favorite as well, listener. That's all a joke. I promise.
I mean, but one of the things I like about, you know, Mutants and Masterminds is the sheer flexibility of it and the cooperative storytelling tools that it gives you. You know, that the hero points, you know, giving the heroes the chance to do some cool stuff. But that being said, there's a lot of people who still like the for whom part of the challenge is the risk of death and the risk of, you know, losing their character. And I mean, I that's the only reason I can imagine that GURPS is still around. But
now I have to come to the defense of GURPS. There's people out there who are listening to us who are saying, hey, wait a minute, I like GURPS.
Yes.
And GURPS is lousy for superheroes. It's the worst system in the world for superheroes because its emphasis is on realism. And in GURPS Supers, you know, anybody can go out and buy an M16 and wear body armor with money.
So it's Virginia.
Yeah, exactly. And but it's... What I'm getting at is in M&M, you have to spend points on stuff, whereas in GURPS, you can spend money on it if you can reason, if you can come up with a good reason for how you could buy it. So there's no reason why every superhero doesn't also pack heat. You know, and
right.
it's a really weird sort of, but it's really good at other genres. Anything where the, like, M&M tends to break down at a very human scale. You know, the system isn't... It's not the most realistic game system in the world, let's be honest. So other systems do that better, but...
Would that be the sidebar where we tell you how much strength you need to move the moon?
Yes. yes, it would be. you know, if you're a GM and you're experiencing this situation where you've got a player in your group, who, you know, just feel like his character isn't working. Well, if you're, I'm talking to M&M people right now, talking to people that are playing in superhero games, Icons or something like that, or Bash or whatever, Champion. Go to your source material, because this happens in the comics all the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, Spider-Man gets recruited into the Avengers. I'm not talking about Brian Michael Bendis' Avengers. I'm talking about the first time Spider-Man joined the Avengers. And Thor tries to recruit him, of all people. And Spider-Man eventually joins the Avengers. And he's with the Avengers for precisely two issues. And then Captain America comes up to him at the end of a session and says, you know, this isn't really working out. and Captain America fires Spidey from the Avengers.
Oh.
Yeah.
I feel so bad for Peter.
Spidey's like, well, you know, I'm kind of a solo player, you know? I just don't work well with a team because I'm so used to doing everything by myself. And Cap's like, you know, this is no reflection on you. You're an excellent hero, you know, because he's Captain America, so he has to get the pep talk. But you know, this, you're just not really, this is a group business. And, you know, and or think about that scene where in the Avengers, again, and this is, I'm going back to my old John Byrne, George Perez era Avengers, where the Avengers lineup is dictated by the government in order for it to express racial diversity. And so they give a spot on the team to the Falcon. And the Falcon's like, what the hell am I doing on the Avengers? Right? And he literally just doesn't fit in. And he's hanging out with all these other people like Thor and Iron Man and Captain America. And the only guy he knows is Cap. He's like the guy at the party who only knows one person. And we have all these scenes where he's sort of talking to Cap saying, I don't really know if I belong here. And Cap's like slapping him on the shoulder saying, oh, just give it one more second, Sam. You know, and they keep trying it. And I think it lasted for like 3 or 4 months. And finally, and there was resentment on the team too, because Hawkeye's like, oh, he's got my spot. I should be on the team. And finally, Falcon just kind of turns around and walks out one day, and nobody notices he's left. And so, you know, talk to the player and say, look, you feel like you know, like you're not fitting in. Talk to the other characters of the group in character about how you feel like you don't fit in. Let's get some role-playing mileage out of it. And if you still feel like you don't fit in, well, then just leave in character and let's see how it goes, you know? And we can make a story out of it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, I mean, that really is. That's why we're all here, right? It's because we're writing a story together. And, right. You know, not everything is happy and fluffy in stories either. You know, if the characters have a big conflict, then, okay, let's just tell it and get it out there and move on. You know, I don't see where that has to be a bad thing.
Yeah, especially if you can move the players out of die-rolling mode. You know, they get in where they're just kind of talking to each other about kind of what's going on, you know, and like, yes, do more of that, please.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the fewer dice you roll, the better the game.
I mean, Eminem has lots of, some people like, you know, they like die rolling. I'm not trying to, because I do too. You know, fight scenes are fight scenes. But one of Eminem's advantages is that you can run a fight scene very fast in Eminem.
Mm-hmm.
If you do it, it can take very little time. DC Heroes was the same way, the old DC Heroes game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, compared to something like Champions, where you know you spend basically 1 hour per character just doing the fight. So if you've got 5 players, then it's 5 hours for the fight scene. But Eminem, you can do it really fast, and that gives you lots of time to get into story and character interaction and detective work and all kinds of stuff that don't require dialogue.
Just puts me in the mind of remembering how I was running games back in. High school how we would roll the dice for everything. Like, I want to convince that player character to go along with me, and the other guy's like, "Well, I want to resist that."
Yeah.
they would use their dice for everything just to be obnoxious to each other.
Well, I have a standing rule in my game that you can never use an ability like that. You can never use a skill or something like that on another player character. You always have to role play it. So. You say, well, I want to roll my bluff on him. Well, then bluff him. You don't get to roll it. You have to play that. And can I roll sense motive on him to tell if he's lying? I don't know. Is he lying? You know, and players hate that because they want to use their skills, but it encourages them to actually play it rather than die roll.
Tonight's podcast was brought to you by Vigilance Press and the fine family of Vigilance Press products. Go buy some today.
Thank you. One of the things that I really like about working with you guys and talking about these kind of these gaming issues is bringing up these kind of perspectives, because sometimes everybody's like on the same wavelength, and sometimes I hear some angles from you guys that make me go, oh, I can take that right back to my game, you know, next week. And I hope that we bring some of that to the people listening. So if you're listening and you have any feedback, like you would like, you know, us to cover a topic, you want us to cover, you know, you want to talk more about the comic book kind of tropes that we can bring into the game and how to do that. Or if you want us to talk a bit more about dealing with, you know, issues, you know, I see so many people on, you know, boards talking about they have player issues, like they're trying to work something out with a player. leave it in the comments right on the podcast website. If you go to vigilancepress.com, it'll redirect you to our web our Podbean site, and it's a blog, and you can actually just leave a comment right there on the page, and you know, I can either respond to it right there or have one of my guests respond to it if they have the time. Or we can bring it into a future episode. Or if you're on the Atomic Think Tank, you can always bug me there, because I'm frequently lurking there. I don't post as often as I used to, just because I'm so busy with my fingers typing other things or drawing other things right now. So I've been kind of sidetracked from posting quite as much. I'm trying to get back into the swing of it, though, and post more often. So
just call James at home. That's the best way to reach him now.
Yeah, my what is it? 555 is the prefix they always use on TV. But no, it's
that's right.
It's BR549, ladies and gentlemen. BR549, James Dawsey. He's there for you 24/7.
976
867-5309.
The first minute is free. $2.50.
Oh God.
We have women on this show, guys.
Yep. He went right there, didn't he?
All right, gang. Thank you very much for stopping by. Jason, Lynn, Christopher, it was delightful. Hopefully everybody at home enjoyed it. If you guys, like I said, if you have any comments, please leave them. If you have any requests for future episodes, I do want to say that coming up, we do have people have been asking us for more actual play sessions, and I do have plans to get some of that in gear rather soon.
We're going to do the fate play test soon, yeah.
Yes, we're going to have a fate play test in a couple weeks, I think we're looking at, and I'm going to see if we can't get another Mutants and Masterminds game session. And actually, we're going to do a Mutants and Masterminds campaign.
Yes.
The goal is to get at least one podcast a month, and actually string the episodes together as a campaign. Let the players develop their characters and earn experience points. Beacon City is the name of our setting for that. So. Hopefully everybody will enjoy that. We're going to do a character creation podcast for that real soon. And I know at least one of my players has volunteered to use the random character generator for that one. So that'll be kind of fun. What's that?
Not it.
Well, you've already come up with a name. You just haven't come up with a power scheme yet.
I have a concept, but I'm saving it until I hear what everyone else is doing.
Yeah, cool. All right. So thank you, everyone, once again for listening in, and hope to be podcasting into your ears again very soon. Until then, stay vigilant.